Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Francesco Caselli. I'm a professor of economics here at the LSE. I just realized I left my notes somewhere, but I don't think I need notes to introduce Danny, so it'll be fine. I think everybody knows here Danny Roderick is one of the most influential and famous economists in the world right now. He has written extremely important work on economic growth, globalization, development, political economy, and he's also been massively influential in the global debate about these problems. Danny teaches at Harvard, and he has written a new book called Shared Prosperity in a Fractured World, which is a book about how we get out of the horrible mess we have created, and so it's a very much needed book. A couple of logistical things. There is a hashtag for this event, which is, I believe, LSE Events. There will be a Q&A after Danny's comments, and there will be a book signing after the talk, and the book's going to be available on sale outside, and then the signing will take place here. I think that's all I have, and now, with great pleasure and anticipation, I hand it over to Danny. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Francesco, for the introduction. It's always very nice to be at LSE and to see so much interest in this work. Can you hear me? Is the microphone working? Okay, wonderful. Thank you. So Francesco and I were discussing just now before the event how long it takes for publishers to put out books. In fact, this book, which do I have? Yes. This book was written actually when the first draft was written when President Biden was in office, when it seemed pretty unimaginable that Trump would be coming back. Furthermore, it seemed at the time quite clear that we were on a kind of a different path for economic policy, which one could criticize, and I've criticized from a number of different perspectives, but in some ways put us on a better path towards addressing the kinds of problems that this book deals with. And so the tone in the book was and is a kind of a hopeful and optimistic one. And then, of course, Trump happened. And for a while I thought, the book was now totally naive given how everything seems to be changing, even from the very first weeks. But eventually, maybe this is motivated reasoning. Eventually, I convinced myself that actually we needed a book like this even more, because it, in my mind, it provides a kind of approach, a set of policies, a kind of a way of thinking, a framework for addressing what I think are our most important economic problems, and that we need that this kind of guidelines to hold us hope that when and if we have some sane politicians and political administrations in the US and elsewhere, that there are things that we can do. So this is, if you ever look at the book or if you buy the book, you'll see that this is an optimistic book. This is a book that that cheers me up. I hope it'll cheer you up a little bit in these very, very difficult times. But it is not, and this is an important point, it is not, sort of an idealistic book. It's not like an utopian book. It says that we need to be doing things differently, and I'll say a little bit about that, obviously, in this talk, about what that means, but not so differently in the sense that the kernel, the germ of all the types of new practices that I think we need, the new approaches we need, are already embedded in existing institutions and experiments and practices that exist in the world. So it really builds on what we are already doing. So in that sense, the hope fullness, the optimism is based on the reality of actual practice. And why is it that that practice doesn't catch our attention or we don't see it? I think there's two broad reasons on it. One is in the case of Chinese industrial policies and green industrial strategy, which I'll talk about as one of the key dimensions of this, is that it's been caught up in geopolitical debates about competition with China. And I think the enormous advances that we've had towards addressing climate change through renewables have somehow gotten lost in that. And the second reason is that I think that many of these experiments remain small scale and very local, and that sort of national economic authorities or focuses on sort of national strategies on growth or middle class or jobs typically don't see those hopes in these or those the existing practices at the local level that have actually worked. So that's my task, to convince you that my optimism is not necessarily misplaced, that there is a common framework that helps us think about these issues. And if I don't convince you in my talk this evening, do buy the book, and there'll be even more convincing arguments there. So why these three? Well, I don't need to make a case for these particular challenges, but obviously, the climate change is probably the one that I need to say the least in terms of why it's important. It's obviously the most significant threat to our physical existence. Rebuilding the middle class, I would say, is sort of like the analog of climate change for our social and political life, not our physical environment, because I think much of the erosion of our democratic norms and the rise of far-right populist forces all over the North Atlantic in U.S. and in Europe and Britain is clearly linked. And I think there has been a fair amount of empirical work that shows this. It's been clearly linked to labor market dislocations, the disappearance of good jobs, which are the basis, essentially, of the middle class, which is really supports cohesive societies and functional, sustainable democracies. So if we want our social and political life to regain a certain degree of cohesiveness and democracy to become stronger, I think rebuilding the middle class is going to be critical. And of course, we can't lose sight of global poverty reduction as an important challenge as well. Now, this actually was one front on which we had made a significant gains, at least until COVID struck, with significant reduction in the number of people who live in extreme poverty, largely, but not exclusively, through China's economic growth. But we've had sort of serious reversals since COVID, and developmental prospects look much more uncertain today. But one of the important points I think that I make in the book is that even there we'll need different strategies than those that worked in the past. Okay, so when you look at these problems and you look at what we're doing today, that even in the relatively rosy world of Biden-era economic policies, there were clear tensions among these things. So Biden was very much focused on the green transition and rebuilding the middle class at home, not so much on global poverty reduction. And one can argue that many of the trade and industrial policies that America pursued during that period was averse to the interests of the global poor. So we need a framework, we need a way of thinking that's going to take all of these on board and avoid some of the trade-offs. Now, these seem very, very different kind of challenges, very different tasks, requiring a lot of expertise in different domains. What gives me the authority or confidence to take them on in the same book? I think there's a common element that ties these challenges together that allows me to talk about all of them as a kind of something that requires a strategy that's broadly similar. Because that all of these are tasks that require structural transformation of our economies. That is, moving economic activity from certain type of sectors and firms and activities to others. So in the case of rebuilding the middle class, it's really a question of creating good jobs, expanding the good jobs in the economy. Good jobs, of course, being those that not only pay high wages, but also provide greater agency and autonomy, a sense of accomplishment, career ladders, being treated well on the job, and so forth. Okay? So that's a problem of structural change, because we need to, you know, foster those firms and activities and sectors that are the source of good jobs. Okay? In terms of climate change, of course, it's very definitely a problem of structural change, because we want to move the economy in the direction of green industries and sources of energy. And poverty reduction, that's a structural change challenge as well, because historically that's how we've gotten poverty reduction, not by simply transferring income to the poor or making them somewhat better at what it is that they're already doing, but moving them to other occupations or to qualitatively different types of jobs which are more productive. Okay? So all three, therefore, share this common element of structural change. And economists know that structural change is rife with market failures. There are externalities, there are coordination failures, there are missing public inputs, all of which mean that the markets left to their own are not going to provide the adequate levels of structural change at the speed that society needs. And therefore, we need corrective policies. What are those corrective policies? Well, in the past, we really thought about the policies that address structural change as policies that are, you know, loosely speaking, industrial policies. Because what does industrial policy do? Industrial policy promotes some activities over others. It is called industrial policy because typically those policies were trying to promote manufacturing industries and hence industrial policy. Okay, so that type of policy is what we required, except that the term industrial policy now is a bit of a misnomer, because it's not manufacturing industries that we need to necessarily promote when we're talking about jobs. I'll come back to that in a second. The jobs are actually going to be mostly in services. So if you're going to want to promote good jobs, they'll have to be in services. By and large, that also happens to be true for developing countries. In developing countries, manufacturing is no longer, for the most part, a labor-absorbing sector in the way that it was traditionally under the East Asian industrialization-driven model. So we need much more of a services-driven model in the developing countries as well. So first is we're talking about an industrial policy for services. Okay? So maybe we shouldn't be talking about industrial policy at all, a sort of productive transformation policy or productive development policy, or what I call in the book, you know, this ugly term, productivism, really may be a little bit more appropriate. And of course, in the direction of green sectors. So the direction of these productive policies are very different than from traditional industrial policies. What are the new elements? The new elements are going to be that, first, when we're talking about good jobs, you talk to policymakers and politicians in the United States, I think, and in continental Europe as well. I get the sense that in Britain, the manufacturing hope has basically gone. But talk in continental Europe and in the United States about good jobs. They'll talk about the, you know, sort of how it's important to reshore manufacturing, get basic manufacturing up and running. This is not going to work. Just mathematically, it doesn't work out. I'll say, so this is going to be, you know, it's going to be really about services and mostly about non-traded services. So a lot of our focus when we talk about the middle class, about trade imbalances, protectionism, the global trade rules, the kinds of stuff that was, you know, my bread and butter when I was writing about globalization, this really becomes much less important now, because we're really talking about sectors that are largely sheltered from international competition, whether it is for advanced countries or for the lower-income countries. Okay? With regard to climate change, I think, you know, the big change, and this is important, is that economists have traditionally focused on taxing carbon emissions, and there's a very good logic for that. In practice, what has worked a lot more effectively is actually subsidizing green activities. Now, It's the second best way of dealing with the climate transition, subsidizing R&D and innovation, but it's been extremely effective. And there are political economy reasons for that, the most basic of which is that it's a lot easier to give people a carrot, an incentive, a subsidy, than it is to actually tax activities, right? So the carrot versus the stick. The carrot approach, even though it's second best, has been much more effective. But this is also something that can be done at the national level, in fact, at the subnational level, because you can combine a lot of the motivations for pursuing green industrial policies with other objectives, whether it's geopolitical, whether it's jobs, whether it's fostering new technological competencies, and therefore you get over the global free riding problem, right? So we thought that solving the climate problem was going to be subject to this incredible problem of how do you get people to agree and to invest in a global public good. Well, China has been doing it through its green industrial policies in a remarkable way. You know, the decline in the cost of renewables that Chinese industrial policies has produced is an incredibly significant global public good, but they're doing it for their own essential sense of who they are. You know, they're, you know, gaining competitiveness, their sort of vision of their national project and so forth. So variety of political economy reasons that some of the common elements in the way that I discuss how we're approaching these is general preference over second best approaches over first best. And I just gave an example of that in the area of climate change. Carbon taxation might be first best, or cap and trade might be first best, but second best policies have evidently been much more effective. My doctoral advisor, Avinash Dixit, used to say, the world is second best at best. And it's a kind of a very vivid reminder of that. Experimentation over fixed remedies, sort of another common feature of the type of policies, whether it is local policies that affect good jobs and productive transformation or the green transformation, a common theme running through is that they tend to be experimental in nature. That involves a different kind of nature between governments and business. Economists' traditional model of government regulation or industrial policy is a top-down kind of a model that you can think of in terms of a principal-agent model that works very well if the dimensionality of uncertainty is small. But when there is huge uncertainty, a kind of iterative, collaborative approach that has a large degree of experimentation, try something, monitor results. If it doesn't work, try something else. That approach works a lot better than the principal agent model. So experimental governance takes over. And another important feature, especially in a world where global cooperation is, you know, we can rely even less on global cooperation going forward than we could until now, is that if you can show that many of these things can be addressed without a whole lot of global governance, that this can be done through local incentives, local experimentation at the national level, countries doing it on their own for their own good reasons, then that's another big plus, that it can actually be done without necessarily relying on this deus ex machina of global governance. Okay, so those are some of the large themes. The question, of course, is that this all sounds good, but are there, in fact, such policies, and what form do they take in practice? Okay, so the book is largely about trying to illustrate what these general principles actually mean concretely. So let me start with the one, let me enter this sort of directly with what might have seemed to be the most intractable of these problems, both because of how serious the nature of the challenge is, climate change, global warming, and how much apparently it relied on the one thing that we lack the most, which is global cooperation. Right? This is, you know, the, you know, archetypal global public good addressing global climate change. Here, the big story, the big, big, really huge, really amazingly big story of the last 10, 15 years is how much progress has happened primarily through the collapse in the price of renewables. Right? So now, in terms of the price of solar, wind, electric vehicles, electric batteries, has collapsed to the point that now they've become viable substitute for fossil fuels. All over Africa now, new sort of installation, new power sources are being essentially driven by imports from China of solar cells and solar power and so forth. And what's important to understand is that no one actually had predicted this. No one thought that there would be such a huge increase in, for example, in installation of solar capacity. This was way outside the kinds of projections, the range of projections that international agencies were making, even in their most optimistic scenarios. And just to give you a sense of how big that is, some of you may know Bill McKibben. So Bill McKibben became very well known in the United States as a climate activist. And he was one of the first authors to ring the alarm bells about climate change and how we were all getting, you know, sort of getting, essentially getting fried under our existing policies. And his most recent book, which came out last year, is called Here Comes the Sun. And it's actually a kind of a relatively upbeat account of how this transformation in the power and the cost of renewable energy is really now for the first time making it look possible, as if we might be on a, you know, on a path where, you know, we won't, you know, get the 1.5 degree, you know, we still will exceed that, but we're now conceivably on a path where we're actually, you know, won't get extinct. So it's hard to understate what a momentous transformation this is and what a good news this is at a time when you mention solar cells, solar power, renewables. You know, the focus of most American and European policymakers is on the competitive threat of Chinese producers, because this has been essentially the result of what China has done. Now, it's interesting that it was the Europeans and Americans who were the original pioneers in renewables. But starting 10, 15 years ago, China went into this in a very big way. And essentially, this transformation, this renewables miracle, has been the result of China's green industrial policies. Okay, what are these industrial policies? Sort of how did we get this? A variety of supports for renewables that leads to an increase in capacity, that leads to learning by doing, so costs go down, and that allows these firms to charge lower prices. The market expands, that leads to sort of more capacity expansion. And so this virtuous cycle of industrial policies that support expansion of renewables capacity, joined together with the miracle of learning by doing, okay, is really what has gotten this. Now, when our image in the West of Chinese industrial policies is still very much kind of a top-down process of, you know, state planners telling what producers what to do, implemented through subsidies, okay, the kind of a traditional model of industrial policy. You set targets, you give firms subsidies to meet them, and then you harshly punish firms that don't meet their targets. This is actually not what Chinese industrial policy was, and I think this is where the entire sort of this new understanding of how productive transformation can happen, how industrial policy does work in practice, how it's much more iterative, collaborative, experimental, really comes into its own. Because as you look at China's practices, yes, it was a strategy that was developed at the top in Beijing. It was developed as a kind of a national project. So that's where prioritization comes in. It's helpful when a national government says, we're going to move into renewables in a big way because we think that's going to be new competitive frontier. The world eventually will move into renewable energy. and we want to be pioneers there, and therefore we're going to make this a national objective. But there was a huge amount of experimentation with policies, as has been generally the case with Chinese economic policies, with demonstration zones set up, localities given national resources to pursue their own experimental approaches with lots of variation across different kind of regions, so with lots of autonomy at the individual level, especially at the municipality level, for different cities to do different kinds of things. There were subsidies, but it was a lot more than simply subsidies. Subsidies are generally easier to quantify, and that's why when you see descriptions of Chinese industrial policies, mostly in terms of subsidies, but there was a lot more. It was public investment in R&D, specific infrastructure, government procurement, these demonstration program, regulatory changes at the national and local levels to incentivize renewables. It's not in the list, but it should be. Public venture capital was a very important form where a lot of localities, municipalities set up public venture capital firms to invest in renewables and then electric vehicles and so forth. This was not simply a top-down process. There was very close collaboration with the government, between the government and business, as well as between the national government and localities. So iteration on both counts and lots of feedback loops of monitoring and a process of iteration and revision, okay? So these are all sort of, in some sense, they were features of China's green industrial policies, but they are general features of successful industrial or productive transformation policies elsewhere. If you look at the history of what South Korean or Taiwanese, or even, in fact, U.S. industrial policies, whether it's the DARPA model or other local economic development initiatives, they tend to have these features rather than the sort of the economist caricature of top-down command control, hard conditionality, and so forth. Okay? Now, I said earlier that China was a relative latecomer to renewables, and in fact, you know, the United States and Europe started on this earlier, and some of that early experience in the United States in particular helps us also qualify perhaps some of the optimism about, you know, and understand better the conditions under which actually industrial policy work and when they can fail. Because the Obama administration instituted a fairly extensive industrial policy program for renewables and green technologies in 2011. And that was largely implemented through loan guarantees of the Department of Energy. And those programs were essentially shuttered after a very public failure. How many people here have heard of Solyndra? Okay, good. So Solyndra was the signal failure of this program. It was actually what made it a failure, in part, and why it marked the entire renewables, green industrial policies of the Obama administration, was that the Obama administration made one critical mistake of, even though these loan guarantees were supporting potentially hundreds of different firms, of which one, by the way, was Tesla, which was saved through these loan guarantees of the Department of Energy, because it was on the verge of bankruptcy at the time. The Obama administration picked on Solyndra as a sort of its flagship, and essentially President Obama went to California to highlight Solyndra as sort of as an example of this fantastic problem. So you can imagine the political difficulty when 6 months later or 8 months later it turns out that the kind of technology that Solyndra had invested in was not going to be viable given, you know, this very sharp decline in the cost of you know, PV cells. And there was a very public failure, and this marked Because rather than treating this program as a kind of in this traditional public venture capital form, which is to say, well, some of them will fail for sure, but those that are successful will pay for all the failures plus more, which in this case was, by the way, true, because Tesla alone, given what a successful company does end up being, Tesla alone paid for all the failures of Solyndra multiplied 1,000 times. But because the way that was, you know, the way that the approach of the administration was simply not to present this as a kind of as a portfolio of programs, but to sort of plant the flag on the one company that was going to fail in a very public way, essentially this became politically unsustainable. So Congress actually in 2012, I believe, even passed a law that was called No More Solyndra's Act. Okay? So in other words, no green industrial policy. So I think, so this failure obviously illustrates a number of things. One is obviously, you know, the point about industrial policy is not that you're going to make a success of every firm that you support. That's the wrong way to think about industrial policy. You simply want to make sure that the portfolio itself pays off and that the losers, you don't keep supporting them after it became, so it's not question, the real test for industrial policy is not whether you can pick winners, but whether you're able to let the losers go, right? Which may still be demanding, but it's a lot less demanding than requiring governments to be omniscient and knowing exactly what will be successful. The private sector doesn't know that either, okay? But it's also not simply the case that Chinese industrial policy has been successful because China is a hard state, it's authoritarian, and countries like the U.S. can't do industrial policy because they are democracies. The U.S. has been traditionally very good at carrying out industrial policy. Look at DARPA, which has been singularly successful in promoting frontier technologies, everything from GPS to internet, which is essentially run as a kind of a semi-autonomous agency through public funds, and is a kind of precisely the kind of a model of thinking about industrial policy or innovation policy, a kind of a portfolio of different activities that certain things will be eventually successful. So I think the China's green industrial policies are important both in their own right, because they're a direct example of how one of our three fundamental challenges can be addressed through these second best measures, green industrial policies that directly incentivize new green technologies. But they're also useful as an example to lead us to pose the question, is a similar transformation also possible in those other areas where we need productive transformation, when we need structural change? Namely, in terms of restoring the middle class and achieving poverty reduction and economic growth in the developing countries. The China's green industrial policies are good for the green transition, but they're not going to be the solution either to the growth challenge or to the jobs challenge. Okay? So those need their own policies. They need policies that are going to directly promote good jobs to sustain democracy and to promote economic growth. And the question is, are there sort of the analog of these green industrial policies for these labor-absorbing sectors, the services in the middle-income countries and in the advanced countries as well? Is there an equivalent of these kinds of policies? I'm going to suggest that there is, although the evidence is scattered and much less direct than in the case of the green industrial policies. But first, let me say a few words about the importance of good jobs. We're in the London School of Economics, and I know the LSE is not just about economics, but I assume many of you are economists or have been in the process of being indoctrinated or being inducted. But I want to make an important point about how, you know, sort of where this emphasis on good jobs is coming from, because it's not something that you'll be focusing on in mainstream economics. And that I think because, you know, conventional economic theory going all the way back to Adam Smith, which put the focus on the consumption side of the economy to draw a sharp distinction from the mercantilists, has had this blind spot on jobs. Because in the traditional conceptualization of what we as individuals maximize our preferences, right, our utility functions, jobs don't enter directly. In fact, they enter indirectly through the budget constraint, that jobs are important only to the extent that they allow us to earn an income, which in turn relaxes our budget constraints, which in turn allows us to pursue the main objective the main arguments that go into the utility function, which is to consume. And to the extent that jobs enter into the utility function, they enter with a negative sign, because leisure goes into the utility function, which is jobs or work with a negative sign. Okay? Now, you know, you look at sort of other social sciences, and of course, you know, sociology, there's a lot of work in sociology on this, and in social psychology, but also increasingly recent work in economics that's sort of asking what are the sources, real sources of, you know, well-being and happiness and life satisfaction. When you ask people those questions, it turns out that jobs have a very direct effect on well-being, because jobs are not just a source of income, they're a source of personal esteem, they're a source of dignity, they're a source of social recognition. And what these studies of life satisfaction have shown is that, in fact, job losses are associated with losses in perceived well-being, personal well-being, that are a multiple of the monetary costs, direct monetary costs. So that if your idea of good jobs, of jobs, is simply as a kind of source of income, is that you could, even if the government actually did, was actually to provide transfers to compensate people who lose their jobs, and even if they did it in full, which they never do, right, you know, you'd still not go nearly the whole distance required to make people whole again, because the job loss goes much beyond the income loss. But that's at the level of individuals. And then jobs also have, a very large, big element of social externality. That, once again, I mean, this is something that's not news for sociologists, but economists have increasingly found out, so that you know, it was a recent wave of studies, that job losses, whether due to globalization and trade, due to automation, or to fiscal austerity, produces significant social, economic, and political externalities. So they may take the form of breakdown of families, rise in health problems, in suicide, rise in addiction, all sort of whole bunch of social problems, and ultimately political dysfunction as well. So there are studies that show that when communities lose jobs, also there is a tendency for authoritarian values to increase. Support for authoritarian and populist demagogues tend to rise. So it stands to reason that when people feel personally, economically insecure, that there's a much greater tendency to want to identify culprits, and those culprits would be those from outside the community. They could be immigrants, they could be religious or ethnic minorities, they could be foreign nations. So there's a direct link between many of the syndromes of social and political malfunction that we've observed and that we associate with the rise of populism, that is directly linked to job losses. And finally, from the perspective of social justice, I think most economists tend to think about social justice in terms of redistributive justice. That is, who gets what? I think at least as important, building on those sort of, you know, the first two ideas, is the notion of contributive justice. And that term is from my colleague at Harvard, Michael Sandel. And he defines contributive justice as the opportunity to win the social recognition and esteem that go with producing what others need and value. So it's not just that we want to compensate people, or we're going to want to redistribute assets and income. It's also that we want to give people the chance to do the kind of jobs, or the kind of work that gives them meaning, a sense of contribution to society. Okay, so those are all reasons why I think, you know, both the reasons why I think economics traditionally has underplayed the role of jobs, sort of now there's a kind of correction being built in, but also why, you know, sort of it's important to bring it in to understand, you know, this new dimension of this new objective for public policy, which is the objective of creating good jobs. Now, so where will these jobs be? I've already said this. One thing we know for sure, these jobs are not going to be in manufacturing. Okay? Manufacturing jobs have been declining in all the advanced countries in the world. So this is for the United States. This first picture goes all the way back to, I think it's 1980. You see the share of the share of all manufacturing employees as a share of total employees. And what I want to draw here is that if you look at sort of this last bit is blown up here, so this is really just from monthly figures from 2020 or something. You know, I can't read this, so there's no way you will be able to read them, but take my word for it. What is the point I'm trying to make for this? The point I'm trying to make is that there's been an ongoing decline in manufacturing. In the United States now, it's about, you know, one job in 12 only in manufacturing. And it simply has not mattered what country, what governments have done, because ever since Biden, the objective has been to basically to reindustrialize, to increase jobs in manufacturing. Biden did it through CHIPS and IRA, okay? Trump has been doing it, okay, with, you know, tariffs. But they both pursue these objectives. You look at the numbers, it makes absolutely no difference. So, you know, up until the last time I looked before, you know, BLS was shut down and therefore couldn't get the data, was that every month that Trump was in office, the manufacturing jobs, the share of total employment would continue to fall. Okay? The Biden administration touted these beautiful numbers about investment and construction in manufacturing that was due to CHIPS. The construction numbers were really quite awesome, but didn't create any manufacturing jobs. So manufacturing jobs. Now you might say maybe Biden and clearly Trump haven't been going about it the right way, that there is, if you pursue the right policies, you know, the right industrial policies and so forth, that you would be creating more jobs. But how much better can you get at supporting your manufacturing than China? Right? China has been losing employment in manufacturing by the millions. In fact, 31 million fewer workers in China's manufacturing since 2011. 31 million, by the way, is more than the sum of total U.S. and German employment in manufacturing. So over a decade, China has lost the equivalent of the total number of manufacturing jobs in the United States and Germany combined. Okay? Now, the big amazing thing, of course, is you don't see it in the output or export numbers for China. They keep increasing. That's just a miracle of labor productivity in manufacturing. So you can increase, you can reshore, maybe you'll increase production, maybe you'll decrease your imports from China. But the point is that there will be virtually no impact on manufacturing, given how skill and capital intensive and automated modern manufacturing today is. Okay, so that's, you know, it's remarkable to me how mainstream politicians, whether it's the center right or center left, have still this fixation with manufacturing as a source of bringing the middle class back and creating good jobs. It's sort of like running history in reverse, because that's manufacturing was the traditional route to creating good jobs of manufacturing. But that's not going to happen in the future. Yeah? Where will the jobs be, if not in manufacturing? Okay, I hope maybe you can read this. This is for the United States. Can you? No. I'll tell you what it is, okay? So this is, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics makes projections for, you know, how many jobs there will be in different occupations. This is for the next decade. So this is looking for the composition in 2034 in the United States, okay? And I've ranked here the top 10 occupations in the United States, okay? The top occupation, home health and personal care aides. Second one, fast food and counter workers. Retail salespersons, general and operations managers, registered nurses, laborers and freight stock and material movers, stockers and order fillers, cashiers, customer service representatives, janitors and cleaners, except maids and housekeeping cleaners. Okay? Of those, none of them, with the possible exception of the tiny big here in laborers in manufacturing, not a big surprise. But here's the other surprise. Of 10 of these, only two require college degrees or more, general managers and registered nurses. None of the others requires college degree. So what does that mean? It means that, again, the economist's standard knee-jerk response to the problem of how do you increase productivity in these sectors, how are you going to increase earnings and create more good jobs where these jobs will exist, the knee-jerk response that you invest in education, you get more people into college, right? That's not going to work here. And so neither reshoring nor investment in education in the traditional way that we think about it is going to do the job. That's why I think, you know, we need a strategy that focuses much more directly along the lines of industrial policies that focus on increasing productivity in these services through increasing the productive capacity of the workers and the firms that employ them. That's going to bear the hallmarks of more of an industrial policy than these general across-the-board types of approaches. Is rapid productivity growth in services possible? Now, you know, traditionally, the reason that there has been deindustrialization is precisely because labor productivity in manufacturing grows much more rapidly than in services. But there are lots of encouraging signs much more recently. If you look at the United States, since 2005, in some of these large labor-absorbing services, productivity has actually increased much faster, not either at the same or at higher levels than in manufacturing. Okay? Wholesale trade, retail trade, accommodation and food services, these are all sectors where, in fact, productivity, labor productivity has increased more rapidly than in manufacturing. How? Well, think about, you know, online ordering, Uber, the deployment of all these digital tools in Amazon warehouses. Right? These are all directly productivity increasing, except that given the way that our current services are organized, the Amazon Uber model are organizational models that ensure that all the benefits are appropriated by the owners rather than the workers themselves. In part, that's because of the type of technologies that are being employed. So if Amazon has a choice between investing in technologies that would allow managers to routinely monitor every single thing, every single, you know, movement that, you know, warehouse workers do, versus investing in technology that is going to increase the autonomy, agency, and the range of tasks that warehouse workers can do, essentially implementing sort of in services in warehouses the equivalent of a Toyota model of production as opposed to a Taylorist model of production, right? Amazon managers, Amazon is much more likely to invest in the first because it gets most of the, you know, profits, it has more control, and therefore it finds it more beneficial. So that's going to tie importantly with a point that I'll come back to shortly about how part of this industrial strategy in services has to be in a public effort to direct innovation in a more labor-friendly direction, which is not what we're going to get if we follow our current model. Okay, but let me run through now very quickly because I've lost track of time.
It's 7:25, so you've been speaking for about 50 minutes, I say.
50 minutes? Yeah. Oh, my God. So let me wrap up. Okay. So these are many of the things I've already mentioned, that, you know, the traditional remedies are not going to work very well, the strategy based on productivity. There's a lot of evidence in economics on how there's this complementarity between good firms and good jobs. This is particularly important for Britain, for example, where a lot of the productivity gap in Britain has to do with the fact that, you know, low-paying jobs are precisely in those regions where you have a scarcity of good firms. And so investing in those good firms is part of this strategy. So, you know, what might these policies look like? In part, they're going to be highly local, so you'll have to rely much more on regions because these tend to be sort of highly customized local partnerships. There's a fair amount of evidence from the United States that there, when, you know, about how this actually happens. A move away from thinking about industrial policy, away from subsidized to the provision of customized public inputs, and those might take everything from workforce and management training to providing coordination to specific business tech services and so forth. And there's evidence from Bartik's work in the US that these customized public inputs are much more effective in generating jobs than simply subsidies. And then finally, you know, sort of this point that I just already signaled, that, you know, we need a national effort, I think, that is precisely trying to develop technologies that are directly labor friendly. So for the United States, I think that, you know, there's the already established model of ARPA, which is taken over DARPA. DARPA was about defense-related technologies, and we've had, you know, ARPA for green technologies, and we've had ARPA for biomedical science, life sciences. Why not have an ARPA for workers? That is an agency that is developing technologies that are, you know, particularly focused on increasing the range and sophistication of the tasks that less than college educated workers can do. So there's some examples of this from these services, whether it's long-term care, retail, or education, how software, AI, other digital kinds of tools can actually enable this, and can talk about some other examples in the Q&A. Okay, there's sort of a developing country version of these, but of course, they differ in that there's much greater degree of informality in developing countries, so dealing directly with that challenge has to be part of it. There's a chapter in the book that deals with this. And then, you know, finally, kind of as, you know, a summary of what this way of thinking about industrial policy or productive development policy, how it differs from traditional modes, okay? So let me just end, you know, going back to that sort of big picture of how we're trying to achieve these things. And the final point I want to make is something that I said at the outset, which is that if you think about these problems in the way that I've laid them out as challenges of developing local and national productive development strategies to develop new sectors and new activities, kind of an updated version of industrial policies, models of which already exist, right, then the lack of global cooperation, the weakness of global governance really becomes much less of an impediment to achieving our goals than we traditionally think of. That's the good news. That's another reason to be optimistic about. Doesn't mean that it wouldn't be good if we had more global cooperation with more global governance. There are areas, in particular, the need to provide technological and financial assistance for the green transition to the low-income countries, where the lowest income countries, where green industrial policies are much less likely to be feasible. That will still require a lot of global cooperation. But the problem simply doesn't loom as large as it would under our sort of traditional remedies. Okay? And that, I take that to be good news as well. So I hope I've said enough to intrigue you, but not so much that you think you will not want to read the book. So with that, let me just leave it at that. Thank you.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you, Dani. That was fantastic. We have some time for Q&A, and as usual, I'll take advantage of the mic to ask the first question, if you don't mind. And I want to bring in Dani, the political economist, into the picture, because, of course, you are a major contributor to that field as well. And I want to particularly ask you about something that came up towards the end of your talk, which is that one crucial requirement to turn productivity growth in services into a source of good jobs is to make sure that the workers receive a reasonable share of the gains of productivity, as opposed to going to the ownership of the intellectual property rights and the political economy question is, in a situation where we have services that are increasingly monopolized or concentrated into some very giant national level groups, you know, you mentioned Amazon. Of course, there are many other examples where there is an enormous thing towards concentration of ownership, and so more and more monopsonistic labor markets. How do you solve the political economy problem of getting the government to tweak the direction of R&D towards technological change that favors the workers, especially, you know, in a world where it becomes increasingly a daily occurrence that, you know, a few extremely rich people, plutocrats, have enormous sway on political decisions, elections, lobbying, political campaigns, Facebook, whatever, you know, there is this enormous pressure from this group of oligopolists on the political process.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought this up, and I think it's an important issue. And so just recently I wrote a very short piece that tried to summarize what the new post-neoliberal consensus is. And I express that new consensus under three headings, two of which I've covered here. One is the importance of returning dignity to communities and workers that have been essentially denied it because of underlying economic technological changes. That's sort of the good jobs agenda. Second, the importance of government approaches to making this make true, because markets on its own will not achieve it. But the third element, which I did not mention, you're bringing, is the general understanding that the concentration of economic power has become excessive in our economies. Now, I didn't talk about this here because I think it's important to distinguish the problems of how you create productive inclusion from the issues of either redistribution or reducing the power of very concentrated and very rich individuals or corporations. But I do think it's definitely has to be part of the agenda. How does that happen? It happens through competition policy. It happens by starting to think about at least some platforms as being public utilities. It happens also by understanding that even though within countries there might be very strong monopolies, across countries there's a surprising amount of variation. There are Amazon-like companies, you know, that are not Amazon in a whole bunch of other countries, and those models can also provide. But it will require the government to, as it did in sort of in defense-related industries, to provide a kind of also a direct leadership in terms of investing in new technologies to show that there are these alternatives. You know, as you know, Daron Acemoğlu has this notion of so-so technologies, which is that a lot of the new innovations that these companies are coming for is not that they're hugely productive, but they enable them to get most of the rents of the new innovation at relatively modest improvements in overall technology. If we could demonstrate that there are alternatives where, in fact, you're getting much bigger bang for the buck, that would also change the nature of. But the point is that, you know, private actors don't necessarily have the incentive to invest in those. So there's a variety of things, whether it is to achieve these ends or to, you know, reduce the power of private economic interests. So I think, you know, that's an important element. Now, the political economy question is, how does this happen? You know, it does happen. I mean, look at how much change we've had, you know, first in Biden's policies and then from Biden to Trump. I mean, these changes would not have been predicted by our standard political economy models, because in those models you have a very well established sense of vested interest. Every powerful group understands where their interests are, and that creates kind of a stable equilibrium that, short of a big crisis or war or, you know, big, you know, climate disaster or something, those are not dislodged, and you don't get the policies to change very quickly. Yet we have had successively very big changes in policy. That, to me, suggests that, you know, on top of these special interest models of political economy, which economists are fond of, we need what political scientists would call sort of constructivist models of political economy as well, where what's in our interest, what's interest specific lobbies or groups, are partly constructed by the narratives that are supplied either by political leaders, by analysts, by media. So my sense of what's in my interest is partly constructed. It's not given by very objective circumstances. The mapping is not unique in that way. And I think sort of, you know, businesses' sense of what is in their interest can change very rapidly. In the same way that business has moved from being, you know, Silicon Valley has moved from supporting, you know, the Democrats to supporting Trump. Now, to me, it makes absolutely zero sense as to why Silicon Valley would support an administration that is so intent on wrecking with a bulldozer every foundation that made something like Silicon Valley possible, right? You know, immigration of talent, you know, rule of law, investment in public education and the national scientific and technological system. There wouldn't be a Silicon Valley, out of that. And yet, you know, you see that, you know, the interests are being constructed in very different ways, in ways that, you know, we may not understand. So that suggests, you know, at the negative side, that things may go really wrong. But at the positive side, it also provides a positive upside.
Persuasion.
That, yeah.
Okay, great, thanks. Okay, so we can go to questions from the audience. Danny, we're going to take three at a time, if that's okay.
Sure.
Because there'll be many people wanting to ask you questions. So question here.
Check. Thank you. My name is Antonis. Thank you for the great talks, Danny, Professor Danny Rodrigue. So I want to ask about your point about the addressing climate change. And yeah, I think if we talk
addressing
about...
Addressing what, I'm sorry?
About the addressing climate change.
Climate change.
Yeah. If we see your idea about the intellectual property and make it as a carrot to kind of distribute the knowledge to the low and middle income countries and make the renewable energy and also green projects much cheaper, I think it needs like a very deep global cooperation. So what do you think about this kind of act in the future, like how like a green technology in the high income countries can be distributed to the low and middle income countries through this kind of a make the technology as a common goods for so we have the speed to reduce the emission, carbon emission. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I will say one thing. There are many people who want to ask questions. So can I ask audience members to keep their answers very short if possible? There in the corner.
Yeah, Bernard Casey wants this place also. OECD economist and various things. Everybody's interested in productivity where I come from. I just come out of meetings about this all day. In your triangle that I can see here, we want to see growth through productivity increases in labor-absorbing sectors. Now, presumably, as I understand productivity, there's going to be less labor that needs to be absorbed. So I'm not quite sure how increasing productivity is actually going to necessarily generate the opportunity to absorb more labor down there. At the same time, rebuilding the middle class seems to be the way you describe it. I don't disagree with what you're pointing at, but actually some of the proposals that you make seem to actually be more about perhaps reducing productivity. So could you talk a little bit more about what is understood by productivity in those two points on the picture in front of me? Thank you.
Thank you, and let's go upstairs for... There, in the back, yeah. Microphone. And again, please.
Hi. Thank you.
Make sure it's a question and keep it short.
Yes. My question is on the global cooperation side and the point that you mentioned that once job loss happens, then things like authoritarian governments take over. So my question is about once that happens, once that government is in power, typically they are not optimizing for prosperity of the people, and this creates a cycle of more job loss, and the typical international intervention of, for example, imposing sanctions makes them actually more authoritarian and the people suffer more. So is there any strategy of international intervention that can kind of help once it has passed that point?
Okay, I'm just going to thank you for those great questions. I'm just going to have to telegraph my answers. Working backwards, I think there's very little that international community can or should do to address issues of authoritarianism in individual countries. I would sort of limit the role of other countries to one of doing no harm. I mean, you don't sell, you know, weapons to a repressive regime which they're going to use on their own people. But I think the ability of other countries to effectively, you know, successfully affect regime change and get more democracy in countries, I think is really very, very limited. Unfortunately, that's something that has to be done from within. So I don't put a lot of faith in international institutions or individual countries to achieve positive political change in individual countries. That has to come from within. On the question about productivity, I mean, productivity always has these two, you know, contradictory effects. On the one, the direct effect is to reduce, you know, the number of people that's been required to produce a particular task. But on the other side, it also enlarges the ranges of tasks that individuals can do, can also increases the incomes of people, and therefore expands the market, and that is the vehicle through which employment actually increases. So, you know, so there's no guarantee, and so that would be the hope that these are the sectors that are basically the employment creating sectors. They will still remain large, but if you increase the quality and the quantity that given amount of labor can produce, you're increasing the overall market size and you're increasing the overall demand for these services at the same time. So overall, you know, the employment need not decline. That's historically has been true. The question about the intellectual property rights, that's the issue that I briefly discuss in the book, that's one of the areas where I do think international cooperation would be desirable. But it is, and we're, you know, in the sense of making intellectual property available to low-income countries for these green technologies. So some of these, you know, technologies can be produced in the low-income countries as well without facing the problems of licensing and patents. That, unfortunately, is unlikely to happen. I've been encouraged that even without that, there is a significant transformation happening because, you know, Chinese exports of these, you know, renewables are so cheap. It's, you know, it's very hard to make the argument that the Chinese exporters are earning monopoly rents on their exports to Ethiopia or to Morocco or other countries that are. So that's a gift for other countries, and it still leaves room for investment in other sort of local mechanism, whether it's refurbishing, whether it's adaptation or mitigation in urban spaces and so forth. It still leaves room for low-income countries to use the green transition as an investment mechanism for their overall growth without necessarily producing solar cells or wind turbines on their own that might, you know, face that problem. So we're not in the first best, but there is still enough of the second best that's still happening.
So back there, yes. Person with the blue. No. You have an LSE jumper, so that you get to ask a question.
Hi, it's Rebecca. I'm studying a executive master's in public policy here at LSE at the moment, hence the jumper. I am fascinated to hear what you think about AI and how that over kind of maps across all of these areas in a kind of good way, but also perhaps a negative way, given its impact on climate change. It's possibly positive, good, or kind of positive on jobs, but negative on jobs. Just what's your thoughts on how AI maps across this and getting prosperity in this space?
Thank you, gentleman in the second row here.
Thanks so much, Danny. Sam Thorpe here at LSE and also at the Productivity Institute. I work with Hugh Spencer, who you've done some stuff with. I'm curious to hear, in some of your earlier work on development, you've been critical at times of financial globalization, and it feels like we're at a moment right now where there are sort of real questions being asked about international financial integration, not least in the US, in one of the places that's historically benefited from that integration. And I guess I'm curious to hear how you think the possibility of changes to the global flow of capital might affect each of these problems, and in particular, whether you think there might be desirable or undesirable side effects of changes in that structure.
You, and let's come down here.
Thank you. My name is Anton. The question is on the climate change policy. Why do you think the carrots of subsidies work better than taxing the carbon emissions? And would this carrots over sticks policy be applicable to most other areas of government regulation? Thank you.
Okay. You know, AI, let me just say two things. One is AI is different from automation, where the clear and predictable impact on workers was that it's going to be basically, you know, reduce within firm demand for labor, holding market size constant. AI can go in either direction. In fact, you know, some of the best evidence we have on what type of workers, less skilled, more skilled, AI helps, suggests that it helps the less skilled more than it helps the more skilled. And that's not unreasonable, because effectively AI is trained on the experience of the more skilled workers, and that becomes a shortcut for the less skilled workers to become more productive more quickly. So this is some evidence from call centers and, you know, customer service on that. But again, the other point on AI is, I go back to what Francisco and I were discussing, that this is going to be very important, where we just don't let, you know, the large AI companies direct everything. I mean, AI solves sort of problems that are in the maxim end of the, you know, that the company has, and that's, you know, not going to be the same as what public policy wants. So I think, you know, we'll have to have a very, I would go so far as to say that it's important to establish, put the hand of public authorities on this, even to the point where it's actually slowing down, you know, the rate of development of AI. And I think, so I'd be very much in favor of that. Financial globalization, I'm still remain very much a skeptic of financial globalization. I do think that, at least in terms of, you know, private financial flows, you know, countries periodically get into trouble because they rely on what seems at the time like, you know, sort of, you know, easy credit, and then, you know, sort of, now we're running this also with, you know, with Chinese loans as well. On the other hand, it's quite clear that you know, public financial flows have to be a part of the climate transition for the lowest income countries too. So I think, you know, public financial flows are, alongside with sort of availability of, you know, intellectual property, access to intellectual property, are, those are the two domains where I think we still need significant global public cooperation, and that we don't. But my views on financial globalization have not really changed, as I remain skeptical. What was the
carrots.
Was
carrots?
Carrots and sticks. Yes, well, I mean, you know, which would you rather have, you know, the stick or the carrot? I mean, it seems like very, very straightforward that, you know, if you tell people that you're going to tax them, I mean, it seems like, you know, you may promise compensation, you may promise redistributing the benefit, you may promise all kinds of things, but, you know, the tax is very visible. The prompt compensation is just, you know, very abstract. Whereas the subsidy, you're basically, and my sort of the theory on, for example, with IRA was that, you know, the U.S. tried taxing carbon and it always failed, and yet, you know, with under Biden, you know, all of a sudden, you know, sort of there was these hundreds of billion dollars of subsidies that firms were very happy to take. And I didn't, you know, there was nobody was objecting to them either, except for a few economists. And I think part of the political dynamic is that if you create sort of enough winners through the subsidies, that over time you can also create a kind of weaken the lobby of the fossil interests and crowd in direct restrictions on fossil fuels as well. So China started very much with, you know, these subsidies, wasn't even talking about curbing carbon emissions, but lately has been talking much more about, you know, so it came later, because you know, if you look at the balance in the United States, now Trump has removed all the IRA subsidies, but a lot of states, including Republican states, are still investing very heavily in in renewables, because the price of renewables are now so low that even without subsidies, it makes sense. So it creates a kind of it changes the underlying dynamic that maybe after Trump, you have the playing field and the underlying strength of political interest changes over time, that might be possible to the carbon pricing as well.
If people promise to ask very short questions, we have our last round back there. No, microphone.
Just focusing on shared prosperity, what would your mindset be about a tiny levy on every share trading, bond trading, or anything in our big trading cities? Surely that would meet the shortfall that Mandani needs in New York, or we need here in London, and it's investment in a middle class too, and it's non-inflationary.
Thank you. Here.
Thank you. I just wondered if you could comment on status decline and how that relates to equality. I think my fear anyway is that status decline, or worries about status decline amongst the kind of industrial classes, is actually a kind of preference towards moving backwards, reducing kind of the privilege or reclaiming privilege against, minoritized groups, women, etc.
Hey, here, front row.
You've spoken about carrots and sticks in the realm of climate change, and in particular, it'd be really good to hear a little bit more about what government intervention might look like in this area. I know that FCA has been looking at sort of sustainability, what it can do, and the current ESG rules have not been the greatest success, let's say, in promoting healthy investment in this area. Do you have any more specified recommendations as to how government, either here in the UK or more widely, could invest and encourage better investment in sustainable finance?
So the status loss question, I do think that it is true that in practice, the reaction takes the form of, wanting to return to a kind of a past where it seemed like everything was better and more simple and your children would be better off than you were, and that was the expected thing. But I think, that's not necessary. Again, it goes back to, the question about constructivism and narratives. And part of the job of political leadership, I think, is to be able to provide the narratives where, you're looking forward to a future and not just, a past. And that's where political leadership has been lacking. But you simply cannot, you don't want to go to the other extreme and simply dismiss people because, they're expressing their sense of loss of dignity and sense of loss of social recognition is taking one particular form, but the fact is real, it is felt, and it is the role of policy to address those because it has consequences beyond, not just for the individual, but for society at the same time. So I think I view it as a kind of a challenge to redirect that sense of loss of control and dignity. If you look at China, the range of instruments that China has used, from venture capital to regulatory changes to directed credit, it's a catalog of inventory of different types of instruments. The point is that you don't want to think about industrial policy, whether it's in the green area or something else, as a preordained list of policies, but you want to think about them as a way of addressing opportunities and constraints and utilizing the capacity of the government to provide a portfolio of different ways of addressing these. So you ask the question, what is needed to make investments and what is it that firms lack? Sometimes the solution will be credit, sometimes the solution will be particular time investment training, sometimes it will be business extension services. So the process of, in all of these successful programs of productive transformation, it's a process of learning about what type of instruments, what type of interventions are more likely to be effective, and being ready to provide a kind of a range of a portfolio of different types of public inputs, and not necessarily taking an ex ante view that we're going to do it through a public investment bank, or we're going to do it through directed credit, or we're going to do it through extra, particular R&D fund and so forth. these things already exist, but how you coordinate them, how you make them available in a particular sector, how you engage in a dialogue with the relevant stakeholders and the firms, you know, that's really where the secret sauce is. And it's a very different frame of mind, this collaborative, iterative frame combined to the from as distinct from the regulatory top-down, arm's-length kind of an approach. Again, I'm missing one question.
Transaction tax.
Transaction tax, yes. The financial transaction, I'm all for it.
Levy,
okay. I'm all for it as long as, and because it will raise revenue and we can use revenue. But I want to make sure that we understand that that's not necessarily the solution to productive inclusion. It's a way of making more resources available for necessary public expenditures. But that's different. The tax transfer schemes are different from changing the underlying structure of the economy in a way that's going to create more productive opportunities for people. And that's not exactly the same thing. I would say there's a distinction.
Danny, thank you very much again. It was a great pleasure to have you.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.